Welcome back, everyone, to our Zohar gathering, midweek mysticism. It is Yom HaAtzma'ut. It is Sfirat HaOmer, particularly important time for mystics, and so it feels worth mentioning those things. Although I'm not sure what, if anything, they have to do with what we're doing explicitly. Joe is here.
Well, in the mystical world, everything is interconnected.
That's right. Right. Of course, everything has to do with everything. Also, in the scientific world, that I believe the butterfly effect is the name for this. Is that correct?
I guess we could say that,
Isn't the butterfly effect about the interconnected web of interactions of all things and all the
yeah.
other things?
The delicate web of causality.
Yes, that if a butterfly flaps its wings, that
Right.
dynamic motion of the air, therefore, will go on to affect weather patterns and whatnot. That's actually a good name for most of the Zohar, the butterfly effect, that a little mitzvah down here does all kinds of things in all realms and worlds. And certainly, actually, I will say this on Yom HaAtzma'ut, the mystical worldview is at the heart of both the opposition to Zionism and the most messianic manifestation of Zionism. So maybe I'll say one word about that in honor of Yom HaAtzmaut. Rav Kook, there's a debate about whether Rav Kook was really a poet who dabbled in Kabbalah or really was a Kabbalist who expressed things in poetic language, different scholars taking kind of different views on that question. But certainly his understanding that even secular Zionists and the creation of a modern state, Herzl and all that were secretly doing deep spiritual things that were necessary for, the messianic era to occur, or they were doing it kind of unwittingly, and maybe that even serves as a correction for the overly religious or pious nature of religiosity that should abandon national or, temporal aspects of living, is rooted in an idea of Shechinah and of tikkun, right? Very much for him, in a sense that when things happen in this world, everything happens in a divine realm, whether the intender is Mechavein, intends it to be that way or not. And for him, maybe even the rebellion was necessary. That in itself took on a kind of kedusha to break from the stagnant nature of religious thought and life. I'll add he wrote an essay called Nishamot Shel Olam HaTohu. I don't know if people are familiar with this essay of Rav Kook. It's a Kabbalistic essay. It's called Souls of the World of Chaos. And there's an idea in the Zohar that there are certain souls from the world of like tikkun, of repair, and there's certain souls from the world before this world, the world of chaos that shattered, old souls, as it were. And you might think it's worse to be from the world of chaos, but Rav Kook attributed a ontological priority in Kabbalistic terms to the world of chaos over the world of repair. The Zohar is very much about fixing and tikkun. But before that, there is a world in which everything is being shattered and destroyed, prior worlds that didn't work, that couldn't contain God's light. And there are souls that couldn't be manifest in that world. So Rav Kook identifies clearly in himself, but also in certain religious thinkers, souls from the Olam HaTohu, and in certain heretics. So he thinks there is an energy among certain people, which is basically rule following and obedient, and then an energy amongst others that is radical in different ways. And the radical souls of the religious world and of the political world and of the philosophical world have more in common with each other. He attributes Rambam as like from the Olam HaTohu, or anyone who broke with the way it was understood and had their own new way to understand it is really shattering accepted notions. And so he kind of says whoever shatters accepted notions really doesn't have enough reverence, kind of. They'll always be accused as being a traitor or heretic. They're not loyal enough to the way it's supposed to be. But he basically says that religious thinkers and secular Zionists have If you're from the Olam HaTohu, you have a camaraderie that runs deeper than whether you're observant or not. And if you're a rule follower, you could be a rule follower political partisan, or you could be a rule follower religious rule follower, and you're the same caste. This is a very interesting essay. I think it's autobiographical for him. And what I'll say about the Satmar Rebbe and his anti-Zionism, is it's very much rooted in an idea that Ad Shetechpotz, that Mimi returns to again and again in Shir HaShirim, that until it's desired, you can't awaken the love. The Zohar sometimes is scared about who's doing the tikkun and when. If you're fixing things, are you worthy? Are you bringing more harm than not? And the Satmar Rebbe clearly thought that this push to have some kind of state was a hastening of the end before the proper work had been done. The people weren't observant. There weren't the right prerequisites for that kind of thing. And so a push for God's love would be premature, and God would reject that love. So everything that is pro the state of Israel for the Satmar Rebbe becomes another thing to provoke God. Every secular Jew that lives in Israel provokes God, and every secular institution in Israel is just one more provocation. And so everything good is really bad and brings demons. So there we have two worldviews, both informed primarily, I think, by mystical thought, that took kind of the opposite paths. Okay. So back to our text, though, Rashid. Because this is all very much concerned with, redemption and empowerment and monarchy and all of that. So remind me where we left off. We had done, the parade of letters, I think.
I made a note on page 117 in the mat, right after the footnote 69 that says, "Return to this paragraph next time." This is
We have learned every Solomon
learned every
mentioned in the
Solomon
song.
mentioned. Yeah.
So let's start there. I have a bookmark in this page, but I don't
Sorry,
know.
what page? One.
Oh, I think we're going back to
117.
115 late.
Oh, you're talking the page book page numbers, not
Yeah,
the.
the mat
Okay.
book page number. So
I was
it's
about to say, because 117, I was like, whoa, you guys did a lot. That was.
no. So in the Zohar, it's Zohar page 1:15b, I
Yeah.
think.
Got it. Okay. I'm slurping some soup, so I'm gonna turn my video off while
No, I
still.
mean, I am happy to watch you slurp soup. We have learned.
More
I
ramen.
haven't loaded the Hebrew yet, just because I figured it was better to just start. But if we need to go to the Aramaic, rather, it'll take me a minute to load it, but it probably is worthwhile at some point. We have learned. Every Solomon mentioned in the Song of Songs, speaking of the Song of Songs, connotes the king to whom peace belongs. I'm going to say a word about the Song of Songs before we start this. We opened with the Song of Songs in the Zohar about the Et HaZamir Higia Le'artzeinu, the time of the pruning has arrived right near the beginning, and also Kashosh Shana Ben HaChochim, Kein Ra'ayti Ben HaBanot, like a thorn among they
Like a
interpreted it as
rose among
roses,
thorns.
lilies probably, but they interpreted it as roses. And so Shir HaShirim is by far the most quoted text in the Zohar. And it's not accidental that the collection of graphic, erotic love poetry is the text that the Zohar returns to, because they fundamentally conceive of the relationship between God and God's self, between people and God, and between all things and each other, as one of eros, right? As one of a deep emotive love. And so, if that's where you are, then you're not going to be quoting Shemot or Malachim. You will, but you're going to quote Shir HaShirim a whole lot. So I think that every time we deal with Shir HaShirim, but here where it's a meta principle about Shir HaShirim, it's worth noting that that's a significant choice in and of itself. We have learned. Every Solomon mentioned in the Song of Songs connotes, now we have learned, of course, is a borrowing from the kind of language of the Mishnah, in particular, the Talmud referring to the Mishnah, something that we're expected to know. It's in the canon. Every Solomon mentioned in the Song of Songs connotes the king to whom peace belongs, Melech Shah HaShalom Shalo, while king, anonymous, lower K in the Matt translation to denote the anonymity of it, not a definite object, but just king generically, connotes the female, lower connoting upper. The mystery, the sod, is that, or the raza, is that lower inherits upper both as one. This is Bet, as is written by wisdom, by it a house is built. Similarly, King Solomon made himself a pavilion from the trees of Lebanon, Song of Songs again. Pavilion is the adorning of the lower world by the upper world. For before the Blessed Holy One created the world, he and his name were enclosed within him. One, nothing existed until there arose within the will of thought, actualizing all by impress of the signet, creating the world. He traced and built, but it did not endure, until he enwrapped himself in a wrapping of radiance, supernal right, creating. I wonder if that supernal right is supposed to be supernal light. I'm going to look at the Aramaic translation. Radiance, light sounds better than right. But I could go to the Zohar text itself to see if that. Does everyone else have that typo in their text, or is it just my book?
Supernal right?
Right, yeah.
You know, that's what it says.
Yeah, it could be a typo.
Oh, I'm going to pause this. I'm going to open up the Aramaic. Now, it's a beautiful passage, so I hate to get lost in the
68.
Technicality of it. But since we are doing close readings as well, I want to make sure we're reading what we're reading.
Oh, he explains right might be the garment of light is chokhmah, located on the upper right side of the spherotic tree. So might it
Unless
be...
Unless you think it's right versus left and not right versus wrong.
Hold on. Excuse me. Let me look for this. Hold on. Where am I? 1 second. All right. Well, I can't seem to find where we are, but that's a separate issue. I'm going to keep reading this teaching. We'll get back to this. He traced and built, but it did not endure until he enwrapped himself in a wrapping of radiance, supernal right, creating the heavens. With this first radiance of all, he created the heavens. The mystery is this verse. With beginning, Bereshit here means with, Elohim created the heavens and the earth. So here we have a passage, and I want to go back and dissect it. So the first letter is Bet. And the form of the Bet, says the Zohar, tells you immediately about the telos of creation. The telos of creation is that somehow that which is above should come to dwell in that which is below. That which is infinite should become come to dwell in that which is finite. This world should be filled. Emanation. So we are immediately dealing with the question of theodicy and of everything. How is there God in this world? Is immediately the Zohar's question, or the question of how does an unmoved mover move? Why? How does God create anything beyond God's self? That fundamental first question, which we're all always just at, the Zohar is again at. And it says, well, bet. By having bet there, the bet shows at the very beginning of the Torah that what's above, the upper line of the bet, is connected to that which is below. They are parallel. You see that? This is bet, as is. So and then they have a proof. By wisdom, a house is built. So what's the proof there? How does by wisdom a house is built show that?
Well, is the house creation and wisdom is above and building is the connection?
Good. Okay. And so by wisdom, so wisdom is, of course, chokhmah, as filtered through binah, a house is built, a world. In other words, they interpret the proverb to say, look, through chokhmah, there comes to be a world. So if you, the proverb is not saying how you build a home. It's saying how God creates anything. Surprise. And how does God create anything? With chokhmah, with wisdom.
There's a whole lot of bets in that verse.
Reshit bara Elohim. It's
a, I'm thinking of bechachma yibane bayit.
Right.
Uvitvuna yitkona. So we have to get to the last letter, the last word, before we don't have a bet floating around. I don't know.
Now, the classic Kabbalistic way to understand this, which I think Matt notes in the footnote, is that bet or bayit, you know, refers to like bina and shechina. If you want to know what are the two lines in the bet, the top line is bina, bet for bina. Today's program is brought to you by bet for bina. And the bottom line for shechina, the daughter, queen, you know, here in our world, limited, but still full, shechina. Maybe in exile, maybe partially redeemed, see your own political views about the world and the state of Israel. And so, that similarly, King Solomon made himself a pavilion from the trees of Lebanon. Right now, what is that referring to? Like classically in the rabbinic. So first let's read the matnota, pavilion, apirion, a biblical hapax legomenon, the only time it appears in the Bible, often translated as palanquin, but apparently referring to a stationary structure. And the midrash, which is what I was saying, is referred to the tabernacle and the temple in Jerusalem. The Psikta de Rav Kahana is a particularly old midrash. We have Rabbi Dr. Mandelbaum, Dr. David Mandelbaum's father, who brought us the Psikta de Rav Kahana, I believe. Without which we wouldn't be able to quote this in footnotes so easily. So in the Zohar, Apirion Shechina, the divine palace, this pavilion is constructed of the Sefirot of Chesed through Yesod. Okay, so what do we have here, right? King Solomon made a temple. So what is the temple? Just like Bet is the first letter of the Torah, is the way in which God dwells in the world. The temple or the Mishkan is the pavilion which allows God to dwell in this world. But so too, we have here the mystical theology of every pavilion. Every chuppah becomes filled with the Shekhinah. And so you've got the breaking of the glass at wedding chuppot that the Kabbalists, you know, want. Probably, by the way, it has nothing, you know, I mean, maybe it probably had to do with like the end of virginity originally. Just so people know, the original sources about the breaking of the glass don't have anything to do with like the world or even Jerusalem per se. There's an early Talmudic source that a glass was broken by one of the Amorayim to limit, you know, intoxication and bad behavior to remind people that life is fragile. But before they party,
that's a brachot, right?
That's a brachot. But for the Kabbalists, it takes on the understanding that if the pavilion is the home of Shekhinah, right, the top of the chuppah symbolizes, you know, like it's like the creation of the letter Bet, then you have to remember that the Shekhinah is in exile, right? In other words, it's not just like we say al rosh simchati, that on the happiest day we remember what's bad, which is the common understanding, but the Kabbalistic understanding is that whenever we create a reenactment of the process of the embodiment of Shekhinah in the world, we have to remember that the Shekhinah as it currently stands is broken. And so to break the glass. But in any event, we have here the temple as the ultimate bayit, right? And so the symbol of the letter Bet, which itself is bayit in its letter, becomes manifest in the temple, which takes on the same thing as the teaching of Bet and is a bayit. Now, it's worth noting that in the early kind of proto-Canaanite alphabet, the Aleph is a cow-like thing, and the Bet is in fact a house, meaning the Bet is meant to mirror a structure. So this is intrinsic, actually, to the letter. Now, pavilion is the adorning of the lower world, that is Shekhinah, by the upper world. For before the Blessed Holy One created the world. So now we get to an interesting moment. God's attempted creation of the world. So let's pause here.
Apirion a little bit more.
Yeah.
So we're saying it's like a bayit, but you mentioned the Mishkan, which was portable, so it really was like a palanquin, and in fact the Arona Kodesh was carried on poles like a palanquin. So I was wondering, where does the palanquin translation come in, and why do we have this strange mix of a palanquin and a bayit, given that the two incarnations of the temple, one was carried and one was planted?
Yeah, I mean, I guess they imagined the structure in the plain meaning of the verse in Shir Shirim, that the structure that it seems that King Solomon is building seems like a permanent one in its description. I forget exactly how they describe it in the rest of that passage.
Well, from the trees of Lebanon, so, and those.
Yeah, if you're making something from the cedars of Lebanon. And of course, the temple was made from Arzel Lebanon, from the cedars of Lebanon. And so it, you know, right. But even just a cedar doesn't usually connote, you know, pine, maybe, but cedar of Lebanon. You know, you're going to the finest cedars in the world and transporting them.
That's right. And the Aron was made of acacia wood, right?
Yeah.
But I just wondered where the palanquin translation even came from, given that
I see.
It seems to work so much better as
the temple, right?
Doesn't matter if there's no wisdom on it. We should go.
I'm sure there is. I mean, we could go to the Pashtunim on the Shira Shirim if you want. We could go look. Should we go look? Or should it be
as homework? Let's do it as
homework. Right.
Okay, I'm not very good at doing homework, but okay. Someone will do homework. Look at the Radak. Someone look at the Rabbi David Kimchi's commentary.
Right.
He's in the words a lot.
Or BDB.
Or the Brown Driver Briggs, which is now available on Sparia. If you don't have that.
Oh, yeah. Great.
Yeah.
Let's see. Apurion. Should we look it up now?
No, go on.
Permit us a pause.
No, let's move on.
Okay, we're moving on. We're moving on. Now we get to a passage which the Siddur, so I want to look at a passage in the Siddur for a moment. Okay, so we've got the Siddur up.
Yes.
So you know this passage is here.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. Right after the morning recitation of Shema, which was added pretty late. Why was the morning recitation of Shema added? Probably when the Shema couldn't be recited in synagogue. I mean, scholars disagree, probably during a time where Shema couldn't be recited in the synagogue, they added it to the kind of morning prayers, although other reasons have been attributed as well. And after this morning recitation of Shema before the prayer service, the Siddur tells us, and the insertion of this line is of sort of unknown origin. Atu atahu atshelo nivra olam, atahu mishenivra haolam. You were there before the world was created. You were the one before the world. You were he before the world was created. And you are he now that the world is created. This world and then the next. Right, sanctify your name by those who sanctify your name. Maybe referring to those that die, Al Kiddush Hashem. See if this is inserted during a time of persecution. And sanctify your name in your world. Tarum. Right, and in your salvation, right, you will rise up at Tagbia Karninu, and how do we want to translate Karninu here? How do they translate it?
They say power, usually.
Power, I don't know.
Pride, but it's horn, right?
Horn, light, pride.
Yeah.
And then some people don't recite the bracha. Some do bracha Hashem mikadesh et shimcha barabim, or a mikadesh et shimo barabim in other versions. God who sanctifies his name amongst the multitudes. So this passage doesn't appear in the early manuscripts of Sidurim of like Rav Amram Gon or Sadja Gon. It's not there. And so the question is, what's it about? Some people attribute mystical origin to this verse based on the teaching we're about to do right now. So that's why I wanted to raise the teaching and flag it in this context. Before the Blessed One created the world, you see, Ad Shelo Nivra Haolam, that's where we are before the world was created. And see the Shla, in his commentary to the Siddur, who links this Zohar passage with this Siddur passage, a descendant, an ancestor of your wife, Rabbi Confer, that right?
Is what?
Rabbi Yeshaya Levi Horowitz is Marsha, a descendant?
No, she's from the other guy, Yom Tov Lipman Heller. I think they were colleagues in Prague.
Yes.
And they both didn't eat turkey.
Right, they both don't eat turkey. The important thing. So,
right.
I'm going to leave the teaching up as we look at the Zohar here. For before the Blessed Holy One created the world, he and his name were enclosed within him. So his name represents, right, a name. What's in a name? A name is how you relate to anyone but yourself, said Shakespeare. And so God needs no name. God needs no name. God has no name. How can God be limited by a name? And so it is daring to say he and his name were enclosed within him. See, already enclosed within him are the seeds of that which will be a name. It's just not latent. Because we're talking, we must be talking about a time for the Zohar where God's manifestation ultimately and emanation is still assumed. Because it happened. Because we're here. Now, is there a time where God had no name? A time, not a time in time, but a time in thought. One, there's no difference between God and this. So there's still a name, but there's no difference. Now, the Matt note says, he quotes a different source. See, Pirkei de Rebbe Eliezer. Rebbe Eliezer, son of Pirkei, said, before those created, there existed the Blessed Holy One and his great name. The thought of creating the world arose in his mind. He traced the world, but it did not endure. They told a parable. To what can this be compared to? A king who wishes to build his palace. If he does not trace the earth and its foundations, exits, and entrances, he cannot begin to build. Similarly, the Blessed Holy One traced the world in front of himself, but it did not endure until he created Teshuvah. Okay.
Can I make an comment that's not in the Matt note, because it reminded me of a passage that I've used a lot in Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer. Ad shelo nivra ha'olam haya hakadosh baruch hu ushmo hagadol bilvad va'ala b'machshava livro et ha'olam v'haya machrit et ha'olam lifanav v'lo haya omeid. Exactly the same words, right?
Yeah.
And then the answer is Kacha Kadosh Baruch Hu. He brings another mashal. Hechrit lefanav et ha'olam v'lo haya omeid ad shebara et hatshuva. So they take that piece and lift it from Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer, but give a different ending to it.
And right, so this is what the Zohar is doing, you know, and we don't always know what it's ripping off of. It's often ripping off of the existence. Right? We have learned maybe all of this already exists. This is all in the Tanan kind of paragraph. We know all of this, but they're doing it differently.
Rabbi, your sound is kind of breaking up. I wonder if you have a battery, a weak battery or something, maybe.
Is this better?
That is better. Yeah, thanks.
Yeah.
Wait, can I hear you?
Can you hear us?
Can you hear us?
I can't.
I'm speaking.
Now I hear you. Speak.
Okay. Can you hear
Great.
Us? Okay.
Good. So thank you. Right. So we have this Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer with Teshuvah, but here it's not Teshuvah which changes the state.
Right.
But rather, until there arose within the will of thought, actualizing all by impress of the signet, creating the world. Now, I will tell you this. This is not the Zohar's most full or mature answer to this question. The Zohar in the Idra Rabbah, a separate section of the Zohar, that is presumed to be the apex of the Zohar, the most developed,
The Zohar developed it even in its own thinking over the time it was published. And the Idra Rabbah represents the climax and most full and complicated statement of the Zohar's theology. And a lot of Lurianic Kabbalah is based mainly on that passage. The Ari took the Idra Zuta, the small room, small chamber, and the Idra Rabbah, the big room. And he really expounded that. There, they give a really detailed account of God's failed attempts to create the world. And there it's different. There's a silk screen, which God is eventually able to engrave his name upon. And there's mocking of God by God. And it's a much more, it's this passage, if you made this passage a whole multi-page essay. So I just want to name that the Zohar will do more than what it does here on this same subject. I almost wonder if we want to see that passage next time now, since we're learning this one, even though we're not fully there.
It could be fun.
I don't know. It will pick up on the idea of, you know, Lifnei Meloch Melech B'Yisrael, before there was a king in Israel, the idea that sometimes gets the biblical academic scholars going about, you know, the early academic scholars about the origin, about the origins of the Bible and you know, authorship. But the Zohar will reinterpret the Malchei Emor, the kings of the Emori, of the Amorite kings, as early attempts, early failed attempts at creation before the king in Israel represents this creation. So it remythologizes all of that. Okay, but so what happens here? And I think we have to do it comparatively. The Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer, which Rabbi Confer notes, is teshuvah. Teshuvah is the thing which allows for the creation of the world. So we're going to, in a minute, talk about what does that mean. But here, it's, there arose within the will of thought, actualizing all by impress of the signet. And Matt has a note about this word and this idea. Creating the world, he traced and built, like the teaching in Pirkei de Rabbi, but it did not endure until he enwrapped himself in a wrapping of radiance, Zohar. Supernal right, creating the heavens. With this first radiance of all, he created the heavens, the mystery of this verse, with beginning. Okay, so what happens? He tries, and he's trying to trace the world, and it won't work. So he has to put himself in the world, right? In other words, the Zohar tells us, just in the plain sense of the Zohar, God tried to create the world, but so long as God tried to create the Rambam's world, where God was not part of the creation, where God was not imminent, he traced it, but he couldn't get it to be real. See, you actually picture here God, the frustrated artist. We had before God, the parade conductor. Now we have God, the failed architect. You almost imagine him there drafting, and he's drafting the world at a drafting table, but he can't build the damn thing. It won't.
I have to say, I'm like seeing it as like a rough cut. That's just my proclivity. Yeah, you're just like, oh, this is terrible. Just go back. Just start again.
He traced and built, but it did not endure, right? So he even does build it, but it collapses immediately. It's not stable. Mm-hmm. I almost think about all the, I imagine that, you tell me why this is wrong, Peter. I sometimes imagine this in physics terms. This is where I'm in danger. Of like every possible universe that would exist with numbers for any essential force, be it gravity or strong force or something, that just simply wouldn't permit matter to coalesce in any kind of stable way. Right? In other words,
it could be that. That's not wrong, but there's actually another version of this that some incautious physicists will say. So physicists are searching for the right laws of nature, but then the question is, if you had the right laws of nature, would the universe come into existence by virtue of the knowledge of the right laws. So you can write the poetic version of that is, you can write the laws of nature on the floor, but will they get up off the floor and fly? So this kind of sounds like that question. You can have a design, but there's separate from the design is the question of actual existence.
Ah, right. Okay. So even if God has all the right ideas about how to create, the wisdom, but you can't, it won't endure. It's not
existing. It's just the idea. So existence is something separate.
It's weird. It almost puts us in God's shoes for a moment to imagine with empathy God's problem. How can I make something exist?
Yeah.
Well, I don't know how to do it. This is a paradox, but they're almost doing it playfully here, because the paradox is like, you know, whatever. Can God create a stone so heavy God can't lift, which is a silly question in some ways. But can God create, period? You know, stuff that is not God. And the Zohar's answer is no. So it wouldn't work until he enwrapped himself in a wrapping of radiance. So why does God have to wrap himself up in a wrapping of radiance?
Because he already exists, and he's the only thing that exists. So he has to transform God's self into a world, not just himself.
Draft the world. He's got to be the world.
Yes, he has to be
the change you want to see in the world.
But is this also like an early idea of like Zimzum, which I presume we're going to get into a lot here, where like the creation is in fact limitation. Like that's what the wrapping is, putting the first screens up to allow the existence of everything.
Yes, and it doesn't sound so diminishing though here. You know, he doesn't wrap himself up to hide his omnipotence. God wraps himself up in a wrapping of radiance, his light and bright kindness and goodness, you know, the right side, let's say, creating heavens, right? So it doesn't have that negative connotation of God's withdrawal, even though it is describing God's concealment, but God chooses to conceal himself in a very revelatory sort of garb, a radiant heavenly garb.
Well, is it also saying, being the book of radiance and light, that the thing that allows the universe to endure is light itself, that somehow God manipulates in a way that the light can flow down through the spherotic channels to the world?
Yes.
So it's not tshuva, it's light. And God then creates this building, this bayit, in which the light can flow down from level to level.
That's precisely it. Now, tshuva in the Kabbalistic understanding is related to bina. It's the source from which all returns. And so it's almost, you know, you could interpret this, as I once heard someone interpret this teaching, as a contrast. You know, the teaching, original teaching, focuses on repentance from sin. Whereas the Zohar is focusing on the radiance of mystical light channeling down. It's a non-guilt-oriented, non-sin-oriented approach to, you know, God's creation of the world. But I actually think that it's better read as a perush on the prior teaching. What does teshuvah mean? Teshuvah means recognizing that, or returning to, we all inherently return to, we all are part of God's radiant light that channels down. The mystery is this verse, with beginning, bereshit, chokhma, Elohim created the heavens and the earth. So let's just understand, how does that verse interpreted in that way? It's with beginning, bereshit, with chokhmah, right? Because as we learned in this teaching, nothing existed until there arose within the will of thought, right? So the first move, Reshit Chochma, Reshit is always associated with thought. So God had a thought to create the world. And we will never know more about the origin of that thought. You know, that's an unknowable kind of thing that the Zohar keeps trying anyway. And that thought itself, you know, ultimately God kind of like wraps himself in that thought, right? That like that becomes the thing that then becomes the pathway for the, you know, bracha to flow.
Well, it's as if we've skipped to the third verse of Bereishit, where there's this mystery, Vayomer Elohim Yehi Or, Vayehi Or. So how is it that speech is like a creative act? I mean, it's a complete mystery there. And this is, I think, riffing on that idea, isn't it?
Interesting, right? Just like speech is a creative act, drafting is a creative act, right? Oh. Mm-hmm. Like, how does God, right? Your question, how does God go from declaring a thing, wanting a thing, willing a thing, drawing a thing, to the thing being? We're in the mechanics now of creation. And ultimately, the Zohar's answer is emanation. You know, if you want to know what the Zohar's answer is, God must be in it. Now, he's not in it exactly. He's wrapped in the light. So it's the light that shines from a garment that God is wearing. So it's not God's light, right? Like, where did he get this wrapping of radiance if all that was God? Where did he buy his clothes?
Right.
You know, like, so, what, suddenly you can shop? Why is that there? You know, so there is a big debate amongst the Mekubalim about whether Or Ein Sof and Ein Sof are the same. There's a concept of, now we're in mystical territory. There's the Ein Sof, the infinite God beyond description, and there's Or Ein Sof, the light of the Ein Sof. And the question is, do those two things, are they synonymous? Is the light of Ein Sof really the Ein Sof? It's the infinite just in the form of light? Or is it some other thing? And if so, you just knock the problem one level up. How did God create? Well, he wrapped himself in a garment of light. Well, how did God create a garment of light? There's something about light which they perceive of as not being really matter, which we have that problem too. What is light? I don't know. I took AP physics and they were like confused. Well, sometimes it acts like a wave and sometimes it acts like a particle. You know, like it's like if you ask someone what is light, maybe Peter could answer the question. But I think it's a complicated question.
Well, I think I would say rather than fixating on the confusions, think of the unification E equals MC squared. Light's a form of energy, and maybe the most, because we see it, it's the most interesting, evocative form of energy, but it can take on material form as matter as well. So I don't really have a physics problem with this. I mean, there is the mystery of creation that nobody, physicist or otherwise, has a clue about. But I think it's beautiful metaphor that doesn't do any violence to physics.
Right, light. And maybe light is good in that way, in that it's a form of energy that takes on a physical manifestation. Yeah, yeah. Precisely what we're asking. How does physical energy become manifest?
Mm-hmm.
And the answer is light. Look at light.
Yeah.
God is wrapped in a garment of radiance.
Well, might it also be that light is a metaphor for the essence of God itself?
Yeah.
So he doesn't have to get light, as it were, from outside. It is an essential part of God, which then the light, the godliness, the God presence flows down through the Sefirot.
Right, so the Kabbalist would say, as Akiva Tatz likes to say, light is a manifestation of the spiritual metaphor. You know, the reason we have light as a form of energy is because this is the idea of God's light. Mm-hmm. Light is God, you know?
Yeah. And, right, but it's also a poetic symbol of understanding and of judging and whatever. So I don't
and rights and goodness and
right. So I don't think it's so different from teshuva or wrapping in light. I mean, at the level of the symbols that we throw around, it's just a slight difference of emphasis.
It is also worth noting that light causes other things to grow, specifically in the plant kingdom. And I think they're always looking at plants. And I can't help but think, just like light causes things to grow, God's energy causes new things to become manifest, including mystical chidush, right? So
I have another Sidur question.
Yeah.
So when you put on your talit, you quote one quote.
Yes.
This verse that appears in the...
I was about to mention, yes.
So please go ahead, what you were about to mention.
Okay, that was the next thing I was going to do. Let's go to there. I don't know if you were going to talk about this.
Exactly this verse, yes.
Yeah.
Okay, so this verse was added... also, we think by the Shla, Rabbi Yeshaya Levi Horowitz, based on the mystical idea, right? Baruchi nafshi et Adonai, Adonai lohai gadalta ma'od, hod v'hadar levashta, ote or kasalma, note shamayim kayiriya, which seems like it is very much, and there could have been a mat footnote, and we wouldn't have questioned it to this teaching, this verse, right, from Baruchi nafshi, which is that God garbs God's self in hod, in splendor, vihadar, and however you want to, hidur, however you want to translate hadar, something beautiful, pretty, magnificent, as the right words. And now we're going to give an explanation of that. How does God exactly dress up in these garments? Ote or kasama. Well, he is enwrapped in light like a dress, like a garment. Note shamayim kayiriya. And how do we know that? Because God spreads out the heavens like a curtain. They're concealing, right? So it's a different metaphor, but it's the same metaphor. God is wearing the light. The heavens have the light in them, literally in the sky, but also conceal God's light in some way behind the contain, display, conceal. So the Shalah understands in his Sidur commentary, Sha'arei Shamayim, he says that his practice is to recite this verse before putting on the Talit. And so it became in a lot of Sidurim in order to show that by praying and putting on the prayer shawl, right, one is, as it were, dressing in a garment of light to evoke that which God is doing as the bottom-up act of connection. If God is communicating to us through light, we are putting on this white prayer shawl, right, to garb ourselves in the prayers or the light. It's an act of communication. It's like picking up the other end of the telephone or something like that. And it feels like that verse, he enwrapped himself in a wrapping of radiance when the Zohar says that, Ota or Kasama. And then they go on to say, creating the heavens, Nota Shamayim Kiriya. It does feel quite like a paraphrase of this pasuk. Mm. Is it quoted even in the mat?
68, he brings.
Yes, in footnote 68.
Famous Midrash. But
the image of God wrapping someone in a garment of light appears in Greek, Iranian, Gnostic, and Kabbalistic sources.
No, above that.
He does quote it.
Yeah. When the Blessed Holy One wished to create the world, he enwrapped himself in light and created the world as it is said. Just quoting the end, right?
Yeah. So next time, we will open with a quick look, maybe, at the Idra's treatment of God's attempt to create before there was anything? Or should we, yeah, Rabbi Confer?
No, I get to go.
Oh, okay. Should we look at a comparative passage of a different treatment of the same thing in the Zohar to see a different answer?
I'd love to do that. What do you think, John?
I think while we're on this, it's fun to see. Here's one answer. Here's an answer 12 years later by the same people. Like, it gives a sense that all of these things are tentative. They're attempts. They're, you know, yes. So thank you all. It's good to be back and to get back into the flow, literally, figuratively, and otherwise. Thank you all. Mm-hmm. Next week.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Thank you.